Great. Okay, we're going to get started. This is our seventh in the series of 10 calls that we do every other Wednesday. Our next one's going to be April 25th as we approach the what I call the long wait, those waiting to hear if they've been funded for this year or we move on. And then also those who are thinking of submitting proposals, things start to heat up about that time. We always start out from news from Washington, so Heather's on the phone. Heather, did you hear anything from Washington?
It is still no news from HQ, you know, nothing new to really report. Again, they're still on track to hopefully announce the fiscal year 18 grant selections in early May, so just keep on waiting. From HMTRI side of things, we did want to remind you all to register for the 2018 all-grantee meeting in Alexandria, Virginia on August 8th and 9th. You can send your registration, just your contact information, to me at HK as in kitten, BALLOU at EICC.edu. Again, that's HKBALLOU at EICC.edu. And I also wanted to let you know we have wrapped up sort of our open end on the certified employee finder scan that we do, as well as the social media scan. So for those of you that did not get the information to us, you will be getting some requests from Bruce Diamond to continue to give us that information so we can create a fantastic document to put out on the toolbox and share with individuals that might be interested in it.
The social media document, it's a sleeper, but it's really neat. I use it all the time. And actually, Janet later will be giving us how to access, I expect she will be, how to access their YouTube videos, but they've done some great work in that area. But what we like to do is try to find out who's on YouTube, who's on Facebook, who's on Instagram, each of the social media. And one of those days when the weather's nasty or you have time and you want to check out a particular grantee, you can go to their social media and just see what's happening, whether it's going into their Facebook or checking out. What's really neat is checking out their YouTube posts, because some of them have some great instructional materials and they're happy to share them with everyone. So that's on the agenda. The other thing that's part of that evaluation that we sent out was your core curriculum and your graduation dates. And that's also helpful. And we'll be distributing that to employers, potential employers, particularly the national employers, because they're working in all 50 states. And to the extent that we can give them a document that says, here are some programs, and this is where they're located, and these are the courses and certs that they have. So if you could supply those to us, we'll make sure you're published in that directory, and we'll make sure that particularly the national employers will get that. And we find very often, particularly in brownfields national meetings, that the employers are saying, well, we do have an office there or whatever. We've got a new contract with this particular person in this city. And they often will go out and seek employees. And if they know there's a staff of trained professionals, they can tie into the network. Many of them, many of our grantees actually are already tied into some, you know, organizations like Arrow, who are the national employers, and they're hiring all over the country. So that's important. And again, Heather is giving you her address. If you're also not getting post-session notes, you indicate to her that you're not getting, you may be getting some reminders, but if you're not getting post-session notes, which we send out on Friday, just email her contact information so we make sure you're on all of the lists. We've got two lists. One is a general list and one specifically for these PLCs. And as you mentioned, we're going to be getting ready for the all-grantee meeting in August. And anyone who is involved in the PLC is also invited to that. And you could ask her for an invite if you haven't heard about it. And as we've said before, and we like to repeat, it's a two-day boot camp, but then 2 days to travel. So there's 3 paid nights that HMTRI can pick up in addition to the conference and meals during the conference, not including dinners on both days. So if you can get to Alexandria in August 8th and 9th, then and maybe support 2 dinners, The rest is pretty much free through the whole time. And that's a great conference. You don't have to have a grant to go there if you're on the PLC, but you get to meet with the EPA people, the assistant administrators. You're going to get to meet with the regional coordinators face-to-face, talk over issues, talk to other grantees, successful grantee alumni, and people who are perhaps like yourself who are applying for a grant or re-upping. And this is kind of segues into what we're going to talk about today. The way the grant is set up is you can't reapply every year. You have to skip a year. So the grants are generally three-year grants. So if you're awarded in 17, you can't reapply in 18, but then you could reapply in 19 and 20. So that means that in any given year, we've got two cohorts in terms of in grant speak, and two re-ups possible. So what that's saying is, and then the other consideration you have to say is, generally 12 to 15 grants are awarded, and about half of those are new, and about half of them are existing. So if you're a new grantee, you've got a shot at it. Sometimes it varies depending on the grants. It might be 8 and 8. It may be 8 and 7. It depends how much money is available. But you certainly have an opportunity to get a new grant. If you're an existing grantee, you also have a possibility. You've done a good job, and you can write a good re-up grant. I call them re-ups. You have a good shot at being refunded. Some of our programs have been actually refunded almost 8 or 10 times. We've got people who have been doing this for 20 years, like Arch Shanks out in California. Several of them that we've had on this program that have been up. But then we also have people who have applied, and they may not make it the first year in the re-up, but then that still gives them another year on their old grant, but then they could have another chance to re-up before there may not be any funds available. And there's also grantees who have applied, got the grant, and went through the grant, and for whatever reason, they didn't get a grant for several years. And then they reapplied. King County's example, we've had in the Northeast, we've had St. Nick's is another example. And the third example, and I'm curious to get the backstory on it, is Santa Fe. Santa Fe worked really hard to get their first grant. It was 2011. This is when they were trying to stimulate the economy, and they were just, they worked really hard and got a $300,000 grant, which was more than any of the other grants I usually. It was that special year, stimulus year. They completed that grant, and then the last we heard from them was 2017, and Janice could fill us in on that. But this is a unique, as I look over what Santa Fe has done, they were active in the 2011 time period, and then kind of, from our perspective, kind of went dormant for a while. And then they came back on the gangbusters. And those of you who got the first notice on the PLC saw the graduating class that they did very quickly. But I loved the picture that you sent us, Janice, because it shows the diversity of your program. And it goes along with an article that we'll have in the notes from Los Alamos and all the wonderful things you're doing out there. So here is a program from my perspective that I'm curious to hear about that was really active, went dormant, and came back and now has this great program that is well-respected in their community with a big diversity and a big disparity in the people they're working with, and actually a big disparity in the employer community that you're working with. So with that backdrop, Janet, I'm going to throw it over to you and have us tell us about what happened.
Well, I wouldn't say that we went dormant. What we used the first grant to do was to purchase the equipment necessary to do a wide range of environmental training for the employers in the northern New Mexico area. So that's what was, that, you know, there's a lot of colleges that, you know, when they do their training, they just, you know, they don't get the equipment. And I've never been a person that believed that you could do effective environmental health and safety training without the equipment. So that was our impetus for going for the 2011 grant cycle. We got the equipment, and that established our environmental health and safety program. And so between 2013 and 2017, we were reaching out to the employers in the state. We were training employees across the state, which I think wasn't that one of the original goals in of this program was to establish training centers, if I remember correctly, Mike?
It's changed over the years. And, of course, the grant you're talking about is quite different than the grant today because that was more the stimulus, getting some programs going. So it's changed a lot, and it's interesting that you were building capacity, but not necessarily. Did you reapply for federal grants and not get them, or was
nope,
it just you decided to?
Made the decision to see, you know, because it was a stimulus in 2011 when we got it. And if you also remember correctly, our curriculum was far more established in the 2011 grant cycle. I mean, I think they had 7 or 8 mandatory trainings that we had to do. It wasn't like it is now where it's just, you know, you have to do HAZWOPR and then your focus can be based upon your need. And I think it was, if I remember correctly, it was because a lot of the different organizations within the EPA was supplying funding like underground storage tanks and groundwater. So they were using that as an impetus to get information about their requirements out into the workforce. So there's a lot of things that changed. So we used the seed money and the $300,000 grant. We spent about $100,000 on equipment, and then the rest was actually for, you know, to getting students and getting them through the program and then helping them find employment. But it was tough. We did not, when we started out, there was a number of challenges in 2011. Number one, the community college was not set up for a job training program. And I know that sounds silly, but most colleges are set up to train students. And so the concept of people going 8 to 5 Monday through Friday was sort of an alien concept in terms of room assignments and registration and things like that. The second thing that was a problem was the concept that we had to provide services to assist these people to get jobs. So we used that to establish our job assistance program at Santa Fe Community College. So that developed after the grant cycle as well, which has been a very successful thing. And we also, in the first grant cycle, we didn't have really good relationships with the employers in the northern New Mexico area. So that was, not only did it help, you know, employers get well-trained employees, we used it, I don't want to say a marketing, but an outreach program for other programs at the college. Does that make sense to you all? You know?
It absolutely does. You know, it absolutely does. And what you said is great because no other college programs, and those of you who may be linked to college, may, if you're not in a community college, you may not understand this. They are so ingrained into credit programs. It's almost
right.
Like you're a sub standard group if you're reaching outside the college campus. Everyone wants to do the degree program. So it's an uphill battle with community colleges. And everything that Janet just talked about is exactly true. You're working with adjuncts or you're bringing in consultants. They're not geared towards going out in the community so much and getting jobs. I'm not saying they're all that way, but that many of them, it seems like sometimes the bigger the college, the more they want to act like universities. And I've seen
Correct.
That throughout the year. And it's a real
Right.
challenge, isn't it?
Right. So that was one of the things. And so between 2013 and 2017, in that 5-year cycle, we were basically continuing to develop our curriculum, continuing to develop our outreach, continuing. And then one of the things that was the impetus for us to apply for the grant for this second time was the federal funding for cleanups at Los Alamos National Labs. Los Alamos Labs has gotten a $10.5 billion 10-year funding to do a lot of cleanup. And in terms of when I was talking to the contractors and Los Alamos Environmental Health and Safety professionals, one of the biggest problems is there's not a group of people to hire to do this work. So that was the impetus for applying for this again, because it's really hard to find those people. We also remember around Los Alamos and in the Española area of northern New Mexico is a very economically depressed area, and there's a very high drug problem. So that makes it also another challenge for us in the northern New Mexico area. As a matter of fact, about 2 months ago, Walmart in Española, they came in and they tested everybody for drugs and walked everyone but three people out of the store, okay? So all the employees. So that's the nature of the drug problem. So what we're attempting to do is to screen people who really want career-level jobs, not just a job, but something, you know, that they can support their family on and have more than just a minimum wage job. And that's the purpose of what we're trying to do in this 2017 to 2020 program. Now, we received notification September of 2017, and we did our first training in February of 2018. And that's because we were pretty much the structures we put in place, we were good to go, and we were able to get the first training cohort out as quickly as possible because we had already got the curriculum developed, the network with the employers, and so all we had to do was do our outreach to find students. And that's kind of where we're at. We also have had to experiment with, you know, getting word out in our community is tough because there's so many different modes of communication now. Some people listen to, are on Facebook. Some people watch the TV. Some people listen to radio. So we can't have just like a focused marketing. We have to be very broad-based. And as a result of what I was doing with the radio stations, I now have a radio program in northern New Mexico on public radio stations. So that's another new tool that we're using now to reach out to people and tell them, you know, not just about the job training program, about other things that are out there in terms of the environmental health and safety profession. So that was, you know, I hope, does that kind of answer why we re-energized our program? Los Alamos needs, according to different sources, between 800 and 1,000 environmental technicians.
Now, the whole issue, and I think you might have mentioned it in one of our PLC calls, do they have stringent hiring requirements?
Very stringent. First of all, most people are going to have to be able to pass a security clearance, which means no major drug busts, no bankruptcies, things like that. We do not do drug testing in our program, but I have a pretty intensive screening process and make it quite clear to people that, you know, drug usage is not going to be acceptable in this line of work because of the security clearance issues and the heavy equipment issues, a lot of reasons, which is also very difficult because we're only about 45 miles south of Colorado, where, you know, recreational marijuana use is, you know, legal. So I make sure everybody understands when they get into this job training program, they need to start studying for that drug test, okay? In New Mexico, especially in northern New Mexico, we have a very dichotomized workforce. You know, we have a lot of people that barely have a high school diploma or a GED, and then everybody else has got a master's or a PhD. That's a real dichotomized workforce, this area. But the other thing is the result of the people that we graduated from our 2011-2013, that 5 years, those people have now, not only did they get good jobs, they are now moved into management and decision-making places within the organizations that they are in. And that's also helped energize our program.
How did you find the classroom experience when you had people? Now, do you take a TAB of, say, 7 or 8? Do you test in that way? or a CASA test?
No.
To...
Before people start, we do a what's called work keys assessment of them.
Okay.
So that when I'm putting the curriculum together, I can look at the work keys and I know how to put the curriculum together. And I think that's another thing that's different with our program, everyone, is I'm not only the program director, I'm the sole instructor. I have people who come in and help. But these people are with me from 8 to 5, Monday through Friday, for 5 to 6 weeks. So I can see their development, where they're struggling, where I can get them help, or I can, you know, pull in additional resources. And it also helps me when I'm, you know, doing letters of reference and assisting them in getting jobs out in the community, is because I know these people. It's not like the standard academic kind of training thing where, you know, you have one instructor and then you have another instructor. I am there watching and developing these people, develop their skills, and if they're falling behind or even if they're accelerating, I can supplement what they need right there in the classroom.
So you're really from the beginning to the end, and you're actually fulfilling a lot of the functions that we ask people to do, when the personal interviews in the beginning, determining whether they're capable of completing the program that you know. You probably can talk to them and find out if they've got the math skills that are required to go on to the next step. What does your curriculum look like?
Our curriculum this go-round is it's 5 weeks, Monday through Friday, forklift operator certification, solid waste awareness, RCRA, hazardous waste, and DOT hazmat certifications. Then they go into the 40-hour HAZWOPER general site worker, and then the next class was the OSHA 30-hour construction standards. And by me being the instructor in all of those classes, I can continue to reintroduce job skills, communication skills, team-building skills, and especially in helping them understand what they're getting into in terms of working with the hazardous materials, hazardous substances, hazardous chemicals. Then we go into the environmental assessments and the different methodologies. That's a 2-day class, and then a 3-day class of how do you pull samples? How do you get samples out of the ground? So they are getting an understanding of what the job tasks are, the paperwork, the actual functions, the equipment, how to maintain that equipment, calibrate that equipment, and, you know, all the paperwork that I had my own company for 17 years doing environmental cleanup. So I know what, soup to nuts, what the program is and the skills that people need to be able to do and what we expect from technicians. I affectionately call them the drum rollers. You know, they're the ones that are actually out there physically moving the materials around. They're not doing the, you know, theoretical, you know, sample deviation type stuff. They're actually out there pulling the samples and filling the drums and digging the stuff up and carting it away and safely placarding and labeling and doing the paperwork.
What I like about your curriculum is very pragmatic. You have a curriculum that goes from very basic, from forklift operators, almost like flaggers or material handlers, all the way up to the more sophisticated programs, so that it gives you a range of occupations that someone might fill. Say if they were going to Los Alamos, or they need people that are operating heavy equipment, but then they also need people with more sophisticated skills, which it appears that you got.
Right. The other thing, and then the last week is more like confined space entry, mold and asbestos awareness. Usually by the fourth week, the fifth week, I've worn them out. Okay. And that's when we go into bringing in the employers to talk to them about how to get into the program. Workforce development comes in and does interviewing with them, teaches them how to interview and interviews them over and over again, helps them with their resumes. And, you know, we start the actual, okay, now let's go get you out there and get you a job kind of
Do the workforce development people you talk about, are that from the college or is it from the WIB?
In New Mexico, Workforce Development has a workforce development representative on our campus, Ted Licht, and he comes in and helps. And his sole purpose is to assist students in getting out into the jobs, you know, into the workforce in New Mexico. That was his assignment at our college was a direct result of the first time we did the grant, and how once we did the grant and they helped us, then we showed them how them working with the other students and getting them out into, you know, from a trade school out into the community was an efficient thing. So we helped the workforce development as well.
Sounds like the college has been a good leveraging partner, and they've allowed you to bring in WIBs, which often that's not the case. And I'm sure they give you training space and the equipment and the labs and everything you need from the college.
Well, and that was, of course, you know, the whole process of getting classrooms in a college is a tough one anyway, but I had to use my personal charm and ability to convince people, you know, to assign me a classroom for that period of time. And that's an ongoing struggle, you know, like it is in most colleges. Now, I just found out one of the challenges I have right now in my grant, I was supposed to be doing my last cohort up in Española at Northern New Mexico College, which they might be going bankrupt. They might not be there next June, so I have to find an alternative.
You know, there's some good news. It's a little off the subject, but there's some good news. You know, the Build Act was processed. They fully funded EPA. I'm still trying to figure out what that means. But in the Build Act, which is connected to that, they're going to allow 5% indirect costs for most of the grants, the ARC grants. Now, I'm hoping that then we'll have to be asking Rachel, is that going to apply to the new job training grants also, which the indirect costs, which you can't charge now, is a problem for most organizations. So if they can give you an extra 5%, it would be a nice thing to have happen.
It would help, you know, with the convincing people to, you know, help me, you know, and I was also very fortunate in that I had the support of the president of the college. And in the year before I started this program, I had made him in profit $250,000. So he was really into listening to me when I said, hey, have I got an idea for you?
Well, colleges could be a curse and a real benefit, and we've seen both happen. Where they've been, and it all depends on the chancellor. It really, if he's a risk taker and willing to do this, it's not an academic program, as we first said. It's not a four-credit program it's a job training program. And so if they're risk takers and it brings them a lot of look at the kudos you got, all the compliments and everything from getting recommendations from Los Alamos. It's a pretty nice piece of work.
I'm going to have to tell Sharon Beard about that at the All Grantees meeting. She's going to like that.
Be very impressed. Tell us a little bit about you're into the digital. Now, I guess will be the second school that's actually using tablets. Florida State College of Jacksonville used them. Are you actively using them or peripherally using them?
No, actively using them. One of the requests of the employers was after send me people who can show up regularly on work, you know, to work and pass a drug test, was they needed people with computer skills, you know, how to check their email, how to get files, you know, how to manipulate documents on the computer. So, and with the cost of copying all the training material so much, and everything is already digital, we just print it out, I decided to get the Fire tablets and just email the students, their training materials. And now, of course, I still have things that they have to do in the classroom to fill out forms. But a lot of the books and stuff, it was like $300 to $350 per student. I got the Fire tablets for $49.99 on Black Friday, and I'm waiting for the next, you know, Amazon special deal. That's $50 versus $350 was a significant cost savings that I could use to purchase other equipment, more air monitoring equipment for the training purposes.
Did you give them to them at the end of the program?
Yes.
Just like Florida State.
Well, the thing is, with tablets, you really can't reassign them to anyone once they've registered them.
Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about Fire tablets is I don't think you have to do as much registration as you do on some of these tablets.
Yes.
It's a little simpler to use. Now, tell us a little bit about, you were talking in one of the PLCs about what you're doing on YouTube.
Well, our students will, and I'm still waiting for the final edit on this, but we interview and video our students at graduation and get their, you know, get them to give a testimonial as to what they think this program, this training, these certifications will do to help them in their life. And then also we have students that periodically just send us the YouTubes that they've put up about how the program has helped them. And that's one of the things it's on. Or we, Santa Fe Community College is also a film college. We have the film students come and film what we're doing as projects for their at four credit classes.
Great
idea.
So
we're trying to work out where we're, you know, involving as many people. And it also, you know, it gets the film students to understand what environmental work really is, and it's not just recycling plastic bottles.
So you could use this as a recruitment tool, marketing tool, as you could send it to the employers.
Yes.
Do they use them? Do employers ever request that, or do you ever use that to place?
Or it's still pretty new. We haven't yet, but we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Now, curiosity, would you mind if there's some of us would like to see them? How would we access that? Do you have a YouTube channel?
No, we don't. It's just,
okay.
And I'm still trying. I'd be up for any suggestions as to what people think, you know, want to do. Because maybe I should make a YouTube channel or put links to them on a web page. I'm still, you know, there's, you know, my program consists of me and my administrative assistant, Evelyn, and anybody else I can manage to grab. So we're still getting to do everything, you know, we just haven't got that yet. It's in the queue, but we haven't gotten to it yet.
That's a great idea, though.
Yeah, Evelyn, my administrative assistant, I sent her over to take the social media training, and she's going to be putting together a social media website for us, and that's going to be one of her tasks as soon as she finishes up her training.
Mm-hmm. We've got this big debate over Facebook now, and I don't know, have you employed those types of tools, or are you staying away from that?
We've used Facebook very effectively in recruiting our last cohort. That and radio spots was the best way to recruit here in northern New Mexico. I don't think Facebook's going away. Most of the people, you know, I don't think it's going away. That things may change, but I don't think it's going away.
We found, in looking at our evaluation or scan, we were looking for some quotes from different students, and we found that Facebook was probably the best source of finding. The big problem with all of these digital platforms is keeping them current. And if you start a website, you've got an issue of maintaining that website, keeping
right.
it current. We have that problem with HMTRI. There's a lot of work. OAI, for example, has a full-time person that's just dealing with those types of things.
Yes. Those are all kinds of, if you have limited resources, you have to decide how am I going to effectively use my resources to accomplish my mission. So.
What advice would you give? And we're actually out of time, but let me ask, anyone have some questions for Janet? Janet's done a great job in planning. She's got this long-range strategic plan that, you know, often when people will miss, they'll reapply for a re-up and they won't get it, and then that's it. They kind of, it's too hard, and they just move on. But it takes a long-range plan to come back and reapply. But you had done your homework, which is
yes.
a difference, and you were very persistent about it. Anyone have any questions of Janet while we have her attention?
Do they all go to sleep?
No. What advice would you give to some of the people thinking of re-upping now? We're going to be getting news, good news or bad news, in the next couple of weeks.
I would say keep good notes. You know, you start out the first time and you just keep building. It's an iterative process. You know, you just keep building on what you have. You know, build what works and get rid of what isn't working and move forward. And just, it's, you've got to be constantly adapting to the changing workplace needs.
You know, we're going to be talking about it in the next PLC. We'll be getting these notices out, or the EPA will be, in early May. So we'll probably be talking a little bit about how, that process of what happens. Now, you had not had a grant and you applied for it. So what, how did that go for you? Did you, now you're close to the chancellor, so they get the news first, or whoever was on the grant, and then they probably, I expect they called you, and it was just a great time.
I called them and say, I think it's time for us to apply for the grant. I walked into Ann Black, the grant writer's office, and said, I want to apply for this. She said, no, it's too much work. And I say, please, 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 please. And then I go to and cry on the president's shoulder, and he makes her do it. And they also get me a professional grant writer to at least do the final edit. That's kind of how it actually happened, Mike.
That's how it happened. Then after you got the news, you got the letter from the regional office, I suppose, and then on from there. It was great.
Right. And we geared up right from there. Yeah, we've kept a lot of the structures in place. And so it's just, like I said, it's an iterative process. You just keep building on what you have. And it depends upon how you've organized your program. You know, I know I've talked to a number of the members in the network, grantee networks, and they're organized very differently than I am. And they have different challenges.
Right. We appreciate your approach. Is it okay if any of the people that read or hear about this discussion, if it's okay if they call you, we'll put your contact information in there.
Pop me an email or a text, and yeah, it's hard to get a hold of me on the phone, but text me or send me an email, and I'll get right back to people.
Okay. Last call for any questions of Janet. Well, hopefully we'll hear from her on the PLC. And I appreciate, Janet, you taking your time in the phone booth to talk to us. Have a great
conference. No, it's not a phone booth. It's a closet.
Okay, we'll put that right up there.
Closet.
Okay, you get a star right next to Art Shanks.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, and have a great week.
Everyone have a good day then. We'll see you on the 25th.